Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore. In this episode, I'll be joined by some of our thought leaders and experts at BSA to discuss emerging research areas in the discovery market. This episode features Matthew Jeans, Tim Stratton, Kate Townsend, Derek West, and Scott Allen as our guests. Matthew Jeans is a principal at BSA and has been with the firm for 2 years and is based in our St. Louis studio. Before BSA, he was an architect at Canon Design. Matthew graduated from Washington University in St. Louis with a BA in architecture. Tim Stratton is a lab planner, an architect, and lead AP certified professional. He has been with BSA for almost 2 years and is based in our Raleigh studio. Before joining BSA, he was a senior lab planner at HOK. Tim graduated from the University of Maryland with a BS in architecture. Kay Townsend is a planning principal. Kay earned her Bachelor of Architecture from Ball State University. She's been designing laboratory spaces of all types for almost 27 years. Kay has been with BSA for 23 of those years and was on episode 26 of this podcast discussing lab renovations on higher education campuses. Derek West has been with BSA for 4 years as a principal, where his primary marketing is the discovery market. Derek is based in our Raleigh studio and received his undergraduate degree in architecture, engineering technology from the University of Memphis, and his master's in architecture from the University of Virginia. Derek has also been on this show before in episode 7 talking about the discovery market, and along with Kay in episode 26 on those lab renovations in higher education campuses. Scott Allen is an architect and a learning and discovery practice director at BSA. He earned his bachelor's degree in architecture from Virginia Tech. Scott has been a guest on this show several times to discuss the learning and discovery practice, student life, serving the client's best interests, and most recently, the Future of Learning and Discovery podcast in episode 32. Well, welcome, everybody. We've got some familiar faces, or I should say some voices on the show with Scott and Derek and Kay returning, but a couple of first-time guests in Matthew and Tim. It's kind of a rite of passage that I like to put our first-time guests through to share where your passion for your discipline comes from. So, Tim, I'm going to start with you. Where did you find your passion for architecture and lab planning?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. So while I was in architecture school, I actually worked part-time in a soils and agronomy lab, and that was for the Department of Plants and Sciences at University of Maryland. It was really just a job to have a little extra spending cash in college. But when I graduated, my first architecture firm specialized in lab planning. So that familiar in labs was a level of comfort in my first job. But once I started to understand how designers and lab planners could facilitate the capabilities of brilliant people in science fields through architecture, I really found my true passion.
Matthew, how about yourself?
Well, so I'm thrilled to be here on the podcast too. My passion for architecture first sparked during a family trip to Monticello, where I realized how intentionally crafted spaces can serve almost any purpose. Since then, I've wanted to be a gentleman architect who became famous for founding a country. But when I realized that wasn't realistic, I discovered that my true calling lies in research labs. These projects are at the heart of life-saving and life-improving breakthroughs, and knowing that my work directly supports transformative research is incredibly rewarding. In many ways, Monticello itself was a laboratory of sorts, which only reinforces my fascination with environments that foster discovery.
Matthew, we should probably take a trip together because I was a history major, and my senior thesis was on the history and politics of Washington, D.C., architecture and museums. Very long title, I know, but I got into some of that as well. Didn't go the route that you did, of course, but yeah, I can see where you would be swayed by that for sure.
Let's take a road trip.
Yes, exactly. Well, Scott and I have previously discussed that it would be a great conversation with all of you to talk about the emerging research areas in the discovery market. So let's dive into our topic. Scott, as the leader of BSA's discovery practice, how do you see these emerging research fields reshaping laboratory design?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Well, first, I think we want to talk about a handful of these different things, but I would just tell you that, you know, these emerging fields are very exciting to us. They're things that we definitely see coming up with all different types of new procedure space, lab-controlled environments, shielding temperature requirements, cleanliness requirements, all these different things to kind of really facilitate the things that our researchers are doing. And I think we're going to try to focus on a handful of those today. We'll start with the idea of something around space exploration neuroscience, quantum computing, nanotechnology, nuclear medicine, and then cell and gene therapies. These are all things that we're kind of generally working on, or each of us has had a little bit of experience throughout our careers on, and things that are really kind of what we're seeing in the marketplace today and driving a lot of our clients and what they're doing.
Excellent. I know these are some of the topics that we started to talk about a little bit when several episodes ago you joined me and we did the future of learning and discovery. So Matthew and Derek, I kind of want to talk to the two of you, recognizing your work with many different types of discovery clients. What do you see driving the investment in these specialized research areas? And Derek, why don't you take the first crack at it?
Yeah. Hey, Brian. Thanks. It's great to be back on the podcast. Great question. So I mean, most of the science that we design for is trying to understand and solve problems, right? That's what they're doing. These problems, they could be environmental, they could be human or animal health related. Manufacturing science or developing technology could be used to support research procedures or, you know, creating new medical devices. What's driving these investments fundamentally is a pursuit, the pursuit to make the world a better place. Certainly, there's money to be made in introducing a new technology or a new treatment, but it's really about trying to eradicate disease, solve problems, improve lives. At BSA, our practice areas are focused on just three things: healing, learning, and discovery. These themes are interconnected with science, this science research. Each of them are. So crossover collaboration is the new frontier. For example, Matthew's going to tell you a little bit about curing cancer and with the use of radioisotopes. Biophysics and nuclear medicine are disciplines or themes that are at the forefront for the development of new medical technologies and new treatments.
Well, it is. Derek was just saying, we're currently doing work in nuclear medicine, which is at a tipping point. It's fueled by major investments from both industry and government, heightened awareness of supply chain vulnerabilities, particularly concerning stable isotopes once sourced from Russia, has prompted the Department of Energy to bolster domestic production efforts. At the same time, pharmaceutical innovators are achieving unprecedented success with radioisotope-based therapies, offering transformative outcomes for cancer patients. And this is only the start. Theranostics, which is a dual approach that uses one radioactive compound for precise tumor identification and another for targeted treatment, is delivering substantial returns on investment. Recognizing growing demand, the University of Missouri is ramping up investments around their research reactor, originally built in the 1960s, to meet the escalating demand for medical isotopes and further accelerate breakthroughs in nuclear medicine. We're also seeing big investments in the pharmaceutical industry with some confidential clients.
This is all incredibly fascinating to me because it's so far out of the realm of what I understand. Let's take a look at some of the emerging trends in a little bit more detail. First, let's focus on neuroscience research facilities for a moment. Just what the heck is that, Kay?
Well, thank you for having me on today. But neuroscience is basically the study of the nervous system. And with that, we see a huge focus on TBIs or traumatic brain injuries, along with things like research for diseases like Alzheimer's. There have been some great gains in both of these areas of research over the last several years, and that's in part because of facilities like the Stark Neuroscience Research Institute here in Indy at the IU School of Medicine that we did some years ago. We see the science take a very collaborative approach, like scientists and clinicians from across different disciplines working together to investigate these types of disorders in neighborhoods or pods, if you will. We developed an approach of integrating the animal studies within these neighborhoods. At Stark, we created a vertical vivarium where the main animal care facilities are in the basement, but the animal holding rooms are located vertically throughout the facility and easily accessible to the adjacent labs. There's a variety of space types in each neighborhood, such as procedure spaces and flexible spaces that become behavioral rooms or tissue culture rooms, along with collaboration zones where the researchers can come together for discussions. It's really an interdisciplinary approach to solving these issues at Stark. And since they are connected to the IU Health Neuroscience Center, it really is a truly bench to bedside approach.
I know you're not talking about Tony Stark, obviously, but when I hear all of this science that's taking place, I immediately think of Tony Stark. So, Tim, what are some of the unique infrastructure requirements that neuroscience research facilities demand?
Yeah, so to piggyback on a lot of what Kay said, neuroscience is a great example of translational research from clinical and diagnostic to biological and medical research. This requires a wide range of lab spaces and equipment, and most importantly, the building systems to support those operational needs. Kay mentioned animal care facilities, and those require a significant amount of ventilation and the correct ventilation, HEPA filters, specific temperature and humidity control, switchable pressurizations to allow for the flexibility of those spaces that Kay mentioned. So if we're going from a tissue culture that would be positive to a behavioral room that's negative, you're going to need those controls in place to do that. On top of all that, there's still N+1 systems, specialty lighting, cleanable surfaces. So there's a lot that goes into the infrastructure requirements of any neurological research facilities.
Wow. There's definitely a lot to consider there. Let's go back to the nuclear medicine. How have you been working on some cutting edge facilities that use radioactive isotopes?
Well, science has been using isotopes for years for things like environmental studies, determining the age of certain materials, and the medical community has used isotopes for diagnostic imaging to be able to trace the progression of disease. But we've also begun to see them used for the treatment of cancer. And as Matthew mentioned earlier, we've only just begun to scratch the surface of how these isotopes can be used in this manner. I personally find it so fascinating. But in the most simplistic way, isotopes are used in targeted cancer treatments. So the isotope is basically attached to a molecule that specifically targets a specific cancer cell. The way the treatment is sent directly to the bad cell, and it does not link to a good cell. So once the science can determine the specific radioisotopes that are effective on particular cancers and the specific target that can link it to that, the sky will be the limit on the types of cancer that can be treated and cured. It really is an amazing science. And honestly, sometimes it's the last hope that a cancer patient may have. And I think that's what makes it so worthwhile and just amazing.
Well, as I've been indicating, Kay, I find this fascinating too. Matthew, what are some of the unique aspects in designing these facilities?
Well, designing for flexibility and future expansion is absolutely critical in nuclear medicine and theranostics because the field evolves so quickly. Even leading experts can't predict which isotopes or therapies they'll be working with 5 years from now. The Department of Energy, for example, might request a specialized isotope for national security, while emerging treatments could require different handling processes and safety protocols. Facilities must therefore be adaptable, particularly since different isotopes can vary significantly in both energy and dose rate, necessitating thicker shielding in hot cells and other production areas. This focus on flexibility goes hand in hand with planning for future expansion. As research and applications continue to experience explosive growth, it's essential to ensure that facilities can scale up or pivot to accommodate new isotopes, production lines, or equipment. By incorporating modular infrastructure, robust utility systems, and sufficient shell space from the outset, facilities can respond effectively to scientific breakthroughs and regulatory changes with minimal disruptions. In our project, that our design for the Radioisotope Science Center includes a future expansion that would double the research and compounding space, as well as the spaces to support these functions like offices and loading docks.
So Matthew gave a really great overview of these facilities, but there's really some unique design criteria involved with constructing these facilities. When you have an MRI or a CT, you shield with copper or lead in the walls and at the perimeter. But when you're dealing with radioisotopes and production lines, the radioactive material is almost always sealed within lead pots and transferred in these containers to and from lead-lined hot cells. A hot cell is basically a large shielded containment chamber that has certain processes contained within it, and it's operated from the outside by manipulator arms, kind of sci-fi looking equipment, actually. And the hot cells can be connected together, and then you have a production line or a train. But depending on the isotope, it will depend on the isotope and how much lead shielding is required. Some can be thicker, But in the end, it's heavy. Lead is heavy. So a thickened slab is typically required wherever we have these hot cells. Some of those can weigh up to 80,000 pounds apiece. So we'll see up to a 12-inch slab under hot cell locations and for a good portion of the building. And even 8 to 10 inches of a thickened slab under areas where the materials will be stored. So not only do you have to consider the hot cells, but all the waste, such as the gowning, the PPE, and things like that, where those are all stored. They're stored in lead drums and kept for a certain amount of time so that they can decay. So you also, in that instance, have to accommodate a larger amount of storage space. In those particular types of spaces, we will either see the lead or copper lined walls, or in a current project, we have 12-inch thick poured concrete walls for the containment of potential radioactive materials, and mainly in case of a spill. As you guys know, I could geek out on this kind of stuff and these kind of facilities all day, and I just find them so amazing.
I feel like I'm learning so much, I could answer an entire category on Jeopardy about it if I could retain any of this information. I'm sure you guys, as you've grown in your professions and become experts at this stuff, probably feel the same way. What kind of design innovations are you guys promoting in planning these facilities?
Well, you know, I mentioned the hot cells previously, but the hot cells are located within a clean room environment as well. Clean room walls and doors, windows for safety, monolithic flooring, and walkable ceilings. You need to adequately determine the isoclass that's going to be required for that space, or the grade level if you're dealing with European classifications. This will mainly affect the HVAC systems for a facility, but it is critical to develop this strategy early. The cleaner the space, the more air changes are required to keep the space clean. Tim kind of mentioned some of those criteria earlier. And if you need to drop to, say, an ISO 5 or a ISO 6 space, you can't directly cascade those two levels. You have to provide an airlock in between the two spaces to provide that cascade. An airlock is pretty much a small room where you add more personal protective gear, like a bunny suit. And it provides this barrier air cascade between the two ISO levels. One of the innovations for this type of facility is the walkable ceiling. It's basically a structurally developed panel that is clean room panel on one side and mechanical space above. Think of it as like an interstitial space without a slab. You want to keep all the valves, the connection points, and the MEP access out of the clean room and above the ceiling. It's actually a very, very complex space and must be carefully laid out and organized so it can be traversed safely by the facilities folks later on when doing maintenance and repairs. One of the things I think innovatively is thinking about the workflow. It's probably the biggest driver of this type of facility. I like to develop a diagram of the workflows for the materials, the staff, the waste, and the product. And then you overlay these and your facility sort of begins to develop around them. And it's critical to manage all of these to create a safe and efficient facility.
Okay. Matthew, how do you guys help clients navigate some of the regulatory requirements that are in these spaces?
So nuclear medicine laboratories operate under stringent regulatory standards designed first and foremost for safety and to ensure the quality of diagnostic and therapeutic products. At their core, these regulations reflect common sense principles of risk management and contamination control. As Kay was just talking about, by adhering to well-defined standard operating procedures, or SOPs, that cover everything from the handling of radioactive materials to the proper use of clean room environments, planners can create facilities that support both regulatory compliance and optimal patient outcomes.
And as I mentioned earlier, you know, as a key element in preserving the sample purity and patient safety, it involves these ISO cascading ISO class zones. In many of these radiopharmacy and nuclear medicine labs, product handling and preparation occur within an ISO 5 environment. When we typically see that inside the hot cell or the isolator, and then the equipment is located in a higher ISO zone itself. By regulating the air quality, the pressure differentials, and even access control protocols within each ISO zone, you minimize the particulates or contaminants and the potential for any cross-contamination that can occur. And my role as a planner is to work with the client's health safety group and their radiation safety person or group to integrate these cascading ISO class requirements. We develop a strategy, as I mentioned earlier, you develop that strategy earlier in the project. We will have to determine the air cascades that are appropriate to support this facility. And this means that you select the right HVAC systems, you set up the proper workflow patterns, and as Matthew mentioned, establishing SOPs for everything from gowning procedures to decontamination. And collectively, these measures aligned with the federal guidances like the FDA, the NRC, and state regulations ensures that everyone remains safe and that radioactive materials are handled responsibly, and that the final products maintain the highest purity standards.
So, Kay, thinking now about like cell and gene therapy research, what's unique and interesting about designing for translational medicine and genomics research?
Well, I mean, similar to working with radioisotopes for cancer treatments, working with cell and gene therapies is amazing when you think that we can take the cells from a patient, basically take it to a facility, to a lab, they can repair it, and they can put it back into that patient and combat their disease or ailment. I mean, when you think of the power of that, it's pretty amazing. And even with nuclear medicine, sometimes these therapies are the last hope that those patients have. And to know that you've been a part of that, I think is really, in a small way, an amazing feeling.
Absolutely. I mean, it certainly gives us all a mission of what we're trying to drive for. Scott, how has BSA-led projects that are focused on this research, like Children's Mercy Research Institute, and how is BSA positioning itself to lead in this kind of growing market?
Yeah, great question, Brian. I think it's one of those things that we're constantly thinking about, but I think it's really the intersection of what we do every day. It's healing, learning, and discovery. So healthcare, education, and research for us. And so that's really kind of where we see it. Academic medical centers, and sometimes even private entities through hospitals, like Children's Mercy is a great example. I worked for one outside of Los Angeles that did the same thing for cancer research. And it really was exactly what Kay was just describing. It's that idea of bench to bedside. It's really kind of the gene or even cell therapy for cancer treatment in some ways. The building we designed, in fact, was exactly that. It actually had a graduate teaching school at the base of the building. And then as you moved up, it had research labs. And on the upper floor, it had a radiopharmacy for the re-engineering of the cells for the cancer patients, for them to go take their own cells and then fight cancer on their own after they got re-engineered. So they took them over to the hospital across the street. And it's one of those things where we see that kind of cross kind of contamination or kind of cross kind of cultural thing and cross kind of research about really how healthcare and research meet on a day-to-day basis and are really at your bedside about how you're getting treated, how you're getting, honestly, life-saving cures for what you have as an ailment.
Derek, I see these articles pop into my Apple News feed like every third day about quantum computing. So let's look at quantum computing facilities next. You've had the opportunity to work on some pretty cool projects for this in our research area. What's unique about these facilities?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Well, I would actually lump in optics research alongside quantum computing because they often go together and each of them kind of have a lot of the same facility requirements. And optics research is generally working with laser technology. I absolutely love working on both of these types of projects, these facilities. And one of the reasons I love doing this work so much is that these scientists are literally designing and building many of the instruments and the tools and the apparatus that they're working with. They're building the thing that they need to study the thing that they're trying to study. And that's about as intelligent as I can say it. They're much smarter than me.
Yeah.
But so these scientists, they tend to be very involved in the design of their spaces, therefore. And so what's really cool about this is the space we design is literally like the housing or the container for the equipment that they're building and using. So the design, the architecture, the engineering of these facilities, it requires us to collaborate very, very closely with these scientists. So what does that mean? That means we get to, for just a few minutes, because I don't want to take anything away from the real work they're doing, but we get to, for a few minutes, be a part of their team and their research. One of the, my favorite experiences working on a facility like this is I got to go back to the future. And because this researcher was literally studying time travel, he was trying to figure out how to go back in time or how to go forward in time. So that was pretty cool. When it comes to what's unique about these facilities, the answer really is kind of everything. And by that, I mean, you know, because the space is the container or the wrapper for their apparatus, each environment is unique to what they're building and how they're going to use it. So while to a certain extent, all of the different lab types that we're talking about today, to a degree, our work is to control the environment that this work is happening in. It's to a much higher degree true in a quantum computing lab. Let me expand on that a little bit. So these facilities typically have standalone and redundant power, HVAC, and plumbing systems. And I'll say a little bit more about what that means. You could think of it really as kind of a building within a building of systems within a building of systems. The equipment they're using requires very, very clean air, very stable and clean power. It's common that the temperature stability required for one of these spaces is a single degree plus or minus Fahrenheit. That is, they're trying to keep it either 68 or 69, period. And then the humidity stability as well is often somewhere between 5 and 10% RH. That's not 5% relative humidity. It's like between 35 and 45% relative humidity. That's really tough to do.
Wow.
Likewise, the power has to be continuous and it has to be clean, meaning it doesn't experience voltage drops or spikes or other disturbances. This can foul up this equipment or this very, very, very sensitive instrumentation. These requirements have to be fail-proof to the extent that the project can afford to pay for it as well.
So really interesting stuff again there. I have two follow-up questions for you. The first is, it wasn't Doc Brown, right?
It wasn't Doc Brown.
I'd be a little freaked out.
It was a super secret project, so I can't say who it was either.
My real question is, you spoke a little bit about these very tight environmental controls, and I know vibration sensitivity is also a concern. So will you drill down into how you work to address these concerns in a quantum computing facility?
Yeah, well, from the vibration standpoint, we typically start out by having a vibration study done on the existing building or the site. And the reason is there's many, many forces on a site or in a building or even in adjacent buildings that create vibrations that could impact the equipment or the instrumentation I was talking about a minute ago. So these things could be happening near the site, like vehicular traffic or train. I had a project where specifically there was a train track that was used multiple times throughout the day. It was about 300 feet from where they were going to be doing this research. And we needed to know, you know, to a great degree of specificity, what did that do to the building? These disturbances could be in adjacent buildings. It can be something as banal as dumpster pickup and emptying, or vibrations of heavy equipment. It could also be within the building that this facility is going itself, like HVAC equipment or freezers or equipment in other labs. We've actually seen where the most impactful vibrations was actually folks walking down the hallway, people's footfall adjacent to a facility like that. So we go through a pretty involved analysis of all of these factors so that we can understand what kind of behavior this lab is going to experience over its lifetime. With that, we then go through the process of determining what mitigation approaches we might take for that specific lab. When it comes to trying to address the very critical temperature and humidity constraints, we go through a similar process. It's really more of like a risk assessment process in this case with the scientists to understand their requirements and the implications or the ramifications on the equipment or the research if the facility doesn't hold those requirements, and that's how we understand, you know, how important they are. From there, we'll engineer the systems to meet those requirements, which often includes pre or post treating 100% outside air to remove contaminants. We might be increasing or decreasing the humidity of that air and even modulating the temperature. And that's before we would send it through, what you would normally think of as the air handling, heating and ventilating, air conditioning system. So we're sort of treating the air twice, if you will. So then we would draw that air through air handling equipment to further condition it to the specific space requirements that they need. That is, that within that plus or minus 1 degree Fahrenheit or plus or minus 5% of relative humidity. On top of that, we often have completely redundant sort of side-by-side systems. This ensures that if something happens to one of those systems or any one of those pieces within that system I described, we've got a redundant one, an adjacent one that comes online right away to maintain those conditions. This all comes out of the risk assessment, which informs the type and level of redundancy that we need to plan for.
And it's almost like you set me up perfectly for a plug on our 100% Outside Air podcast that we just had a few episodes ago. So thanks for doing that. Scott, getting back to the first emerging frontier, and I've been waiting to ask this. I'm fascinated by space exploration. So you talked a little bit about space exploration research, which I, again, find fascinating. What kind of unique challenges do you face when you're designing facilities for space-related research?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brian. We've talked about all these things that we sort of know about. I think space is one of those things that we're still constantly learning about. So we know what we know, but we also know what we don't know. And that's really kind of an exciting part of it, to be truthfully honest. And you also think about the environments that are up there. Those environments are very, very different than what we encounter here. And trying to either recreate them and or whatever we would bring back from that environment, how we can actually even study it and have it be stabilized, I think are some of the first questions that kind of come to mind related to that. You know, it's a very harsh place in some ways. And trying to think about that you don't either bring something back that irradiates the human that's trying to actually study it in a way that's harmful or cause some other problem when it comes into our atmosphere and does something that we can't even anticipate. So you try to really bring it into a space that's really kind of controlled. I think we listened to Derek, listened to Kay, and even Matthew and Tim talk about their different spaces. This one's really about trying to contain what you bring into it and not letting anything get beyond it. So in case something were to happen in that consideration. And so it's really those thinking about those samples. I mean, we've learned a lot about different surfaces that we've been able to go to a little bit when we went to the moon. You know, they brought back rocks and all these things in the past. And so the hope is when we go to Mars, I mean, there's conversation of going to Mars at some point, not too far in the distant future, that we're able to bring things back and understand that and hopefully help our planet in its own way. I think it's just one of those things that we're fortunate to be able to do. I personally have a friend through my wife who's an astronaut. He talks about this and the importance of this all the time and why he does what he does. He's a doctor by training, but also a scientist, and he goes up to space for those reasons. He's all about trying to bring back and help heal people, help heal our planet. And then we can learn about our atmosphere and learn about our natural disasters potentially from it as well. So it's all pretty interesting. I think, like I said from the outset, it's really about what we don't know and trying to find out about that and try to learn more about it on a constant basis.
I find it fascinating. You just casually drop that you're friends with an astronaut. I can't imagine what those dinner conversations are like. And if there's ever a chance that when I'm in Denver, I could just sit in for a little bit and maybe have a glass of wine with you guys, I think that'd be fantastic. I would love
absolutely anytime, Brian.
I was going to add to what Scott and Derek have already talked about is the level of security that's really required for these kind of spaces. I also have a client, of which shall not be named, that I worked on a project for them. And we went to the extent of installing wire mesh in between layers of drywall. They had bulletproof or shatterproof glass. We had blinds on the windows. They wanted you to be able to see in when they wanted you to be able to see in and not when they didn't want you to be able to see in. And they had requirements for ducts that could only be so big so that a person couldn't shimmy through there and get into the space. So, I mean, there was a whole level there that I'd never experienced before.
Yeah, you get lost in the storytelling of the films and TV shows that we watch, right? Like Interstellar, For All Mankind. It's such a harsh space. Tim, I haven't heard from you in a little while, so let me direct a question your way. At a high level, how has lab design been working to understand, solve, and kind of accommodate these cutting edge research demands?
Sure. So I think there's two things that we're seeing. One is we're really seeing a blending of disciplines. Fortunately, Gone seems to be the days of a PI in a small enclosed lab. Now we're designing large open lab spaces with integral collaboration zones that are shared by scientists of all types. For example, at the University of Notre Dame, at their new Research 2 building, they actually sent out RFPs for interdisciplinary teams to be housed in these new labs. They were developed with a neighborhood concept, and so that allows scientists from almost any discipline, like a biologist, a chemist, and maybe even an ecologist, could be forming a partnership and working collectively on solving issues that affect humanity in one open lab space. The second area we're seeing the most evolution is the lab support space. So you have your open lab and you have your lab support. This area is becoming more specialized to meet the needs of the equipment and the technology that's really driving this innovation in so many fields. Equipment core labs have become very popular to centralize shared equipment, such as all your mass specs or your NMRs or HPLCs, imaging equipment, can all be located in these cores spread out throughout the building with the appropriate utilities going to each of those core labs and having knowledgeable, dedicated staff to operate that specialty equipment.
That's really cool. And I'm glad you mentioned the Notre Dame Research 2 project. I had the fortunate opportunity to go to the first college football playoff game back in December and walk past it under construction, looking fantastic. Derek, thinking about these typical lab types, how are you designing to integrate wet lab, computational, and imaging spaces?
Well, one interesting dynamic, and I think Matthew touched on this as well, is that the science itself is changing faster than the buildings can be updated to support it. That means that we've got to be designing these labs and support spaces to either be flexible so they can accommodate different ways of working without making changes to them, or they need to be adaptable, which is to be designed so that they are relatively easy to modify and accommodate changes when the research technology, the research theme changes. Space is a premium everywhere. Labs are expensive. They're among the most expensive places, you know, on a campus. So modifying or renovating buildings, you know, like this takes time. So how do we sort of reconcile all these things? One approach may be to spend more money up front to make things more flexible. Another approach may be to build in redundancy. We've talked about redundancy. Tim mentioned N+1. That's when we say N+1, meaning like battery backup plus another battery backup. So build in that redundancy and thereby creating a relative ease of extending or modifying infrastructure in the future. And then I think one thing really important that Tim just mentioned is that these equipment, these core labs they're still important, but these are incredibly specific spaces. And it's the kind of thing that not every investigator, every research team uses every day. They need it sometimes, but not all of the time. So what we can do is invest money in these very specific spaces. We make them a shared resource. And then the other spaces that the investigators are working in, those are the ones that are where we're seeing this flexibility and adaptability. So there's kind of a both and approach to accommodating these future changes.
So a couple more words about computational laboratories. These are often called dry labs. They're expanding rapidly as more research can be done in silico using high-performance computing resources, including GPUs and graphic processing units. Although GPU-driven computing was well established in fields such as physics and computer graphics over a decade ago, its role in scientific research has steadily grown and underpins much of today's surge in AI and machine learning. Alongside this computational revolution, significant portions of research workflows have moved to cloud-based platforms, enabling faster data processing, easier collaboration, and the capacity to simulate or screen potential experiments before conducting them in traditional wet labs. By optimizing experimental design and reducing costly trial and error, these approaches help wet lab work become more focused and efficient, giving ongoing developments in GPU architectures, cloud services, and AI tools. This trend is poised to continue and likely accelerate over the coming years.
Tim, how are you addressing sustainability in these energy-intensive research areas?
Yeah, so buildings in general contribute a significant number of emissions. Lab buildings in particular, their requirements for ventilation and heat loads, et cetera, require even more energy than, say, an office building. To design a sustainable, high-performance research building, it requires the lab planners, the architects, the engineers, and the client to be all in on building a sustainable building. This includes the building envelope, to fully electric heat pumps, to specifying more efficient lab equipment like sterilizers, to higher upfront costs of a less traditional building system. Everybody needs to be on board to design a sustainable research building without sacrificing the safety of the research or compromising the validity of the science.
Wow. I mean, there's been so much here, and I feel like we're hitting the peak of all these different exciting research types. It's such a neat time to be alive, but also for our firm to be a part of these. And I'm sure there's so much more that we could get into. Let's talk a little bit about how BSA partners with our clients to create spaces that enable them to do this important work. So, Scott, how does BSA's integrated approach benefit these complex projects?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brian. I mean, BSA as an integrated firm, so architecture, planning, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, engineering, technology, is a really important part of this, right? Our teams are able to look at our projects very holistically. And I mean that from not only beginning to end, but really as not only design and planning, but design, planning, and systems all at one time. And I think that's a really important part of this because when you start to think about that from the beginning, the inception from not only programming to concept design about how those things integrate with each other, it really makes you start to think a little bit differently. And it particularly makes you think about what is going on with not only the design, but then the planning, how that contributes to security, how that might contribute to the different aspects of sustainability, like we're just talking about just now, the function, those concerns are all at the forefront of what we're considering. And they're thought about at all levels. And they really bring forth an idea of how then you can either, as Derek was talking about, the adaptability, the flexibility of the lab space itself, that idea of how do we can modify, how we can expand, or how we can even move forward with the change of science. Lab buildings and lab spaces are so expensive. Typically, it becomes this conversation about how do you make those adjustments in a way that makes sense and you create the right infrastructure for that flexibility to be there in the future. So for us to do that, we look at those from a very holistic perspective. We bring all of our systems and all of our team together to do that. And I think it's actually not only a partially unique expression of how we do it, but it allows us to give a much more complete design for the future and for our clients to get the most out of what they're doing and be good stewards of the funds that they have to do the work that they're doing in research.
So I know we've got a couple of confidential projects that we're working on and we can't get too much into them, but are there any overarching lessons that we've learned from those currently and anything that you can share about them, Scott?
Yeah, you know, while I can't share too much about them, Brian, I can share that, you know, where research and technology and discovery is driving and where it's going forward is amazing to watch. We love being at the forefront of that with our clients, but I can also tell you that they're working on new things from new technology to new therapies to drugs that will be new treatments for disease. Ultimately, that's one of the reasons we all sat and got involved in this. You heard Tim Stratton talk about how he got into it, or Matthew and others. I mean, we're wanting to be impactful on a day-to-day what we do. And that's why each of us is here. We feel like that the science space, the discovery space is one of those places where that impact happens the most. At least that's what I feel like personally, and one of the reasons I love it the most. And we want to continue to help our clients do that. And we do that through our expertise. I think hopefully today, as we've talked about what we do, what we understand, and why we're actually kind of like case as nerds about this at a certain level, it's really important to us. We know we're not maybe, or I know I'm not the smartest person in the room with some of these researchers, but I can always learn something from them. We bring something to every part of our projects, and from project to project in that process. And to me, that's really exciting. I mean, it gets me up every day to go do what we do. And I think it's thrilling, personally, for us to help our clients in that way.
I agree with you. I feel like you feel right now. I am the least smart person in this room, but it has been so fun to hear all these different areas of the emerging fields that we're talking about in terms of research. Tim, I'm going to save the last question here for you because I love asking futuristic based questions. And this whole podcast has really been talking about some of those things that are emerging and on the cusp of coming in the future. But I feel like some of the other folks that I've had on before and they've had a chance to answer some things. So what excites you the most about the future of the research facility design space?
Yeah, so something that really excites me that probably scares a lot of people is, and we touched on designing for future flexibility of these emerging research areas, but there's one thing for certain, and that's AI will be a powerful tool of research in the future. So here at BSA, we're working with our clients to really gauge their comfort level of using AI to design their buildings. So we're starting to implement AI tools to assist in developing a better design for their facility. And at the same time, we're following market trends in the industry and asking our clients the right questions to really see how they see themselves working with AI in the future and begin planning for those future needs.
Well, that's a perfect bow on it. I want to thank all of you for joining today. I really appreciate you coming on. This has been one of the more fun conversations, honestly, that I've had because it's just also fascinating to me. So thank you guys. And Derek, if I know you can't say, but if you run into Doc Brown, tell him I said hello.
Will do.
I'd like to thank Matthew, Tim, Kay, Derek, and Scott again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA and our expertise, we encourage you to visit our website, bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. And be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. We've got more content and project stories that we share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.